Thanks to everybody else who read, and welcome to those that have joined us since we first started. Particular welcome to any newcomers and visitors to our meeting this evening. And we hope you hear something that will encourage you to keep coming back. And we do have a speaker tonight, and I'm going to hand you over to Joe to introduce him. So, Joe, over to you.
I'm an addict. My name is Joe.
Hello, Jay.
Hi, Jay.
I met Bruce. Probably, well, I met Bruce back in the 80s, and exactly when, I can't remember, but I know that when the convention was in Orlando, our Frickna 5, and we just did Frickna 38, I became the program chair of that convention, and he, at that point, he lived in Orlando, and was working on the convention with the rest of us, and we got to know each other better in service, and we've known each other ever since. And he has done a lot of different things in his recovery, and I get to go a lot of different places because he has been a world traveler in Narcotics Anonymous, and I will let him tell you about that. And I look forward to hearing him share, because I got a chance to see him last weekend and spend some time with him and break bread, and it was quite enjoyable. I mean, don't always get to do that with people that we've known, and it was a good time. There was three people with substantial clean time sitting around the table just shooting the shit, and it was really good. So without further ado, Bruce, would you share with us?
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Bruce. I have the disease. I'm one of Hi. God's greatest miracles.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
My tongue is all sore, so I'm going to try to speak as best as I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hello?
We can hear you, Bruce.
Yeah, we can hear you fine, Bruce.
Okay, okay. I wasn't sure. I'm very insecure, you know. I got to know people are there. Anyway, my clean date is June 19th, 1981. And by the grace of God and a program, I haven't had to use ever since. Doesn't mean I hadn't had the desire, doesn't mean I hadn't tried, but God intervened at those times when I tried. And that's part of my story. So I was born in a nice, loving family, very affectionate, very, a lot of joking around, and, you know, very caring. But at the same time, I had a mother who was at times overbearing, in my opinion, and at times very supportive. I'll tell you a story that I tell a lot about my mother when I was born. My grandmother came in the room at a hospital, and my mother had me in her arms, and she was crying. And my grandmother said, "Why are you crying?" And my mother said, "Look at him, he's so ugly." My grandmother said, "Oh no, don't be crying. He's a beautiful baby boy. He's the most beautiful baby boy." And my mother, with tears in her eyes, goes, "You think so, really?" She goes, "Oh yeah, he's so beautiful." So about a year and a half later, my aunties were with my grandma in the other room. And I guess my mother overheard them speaking because they were playing with me. And they said to my grandma, "Little Brucey, he is so adorable." And my grandmother said, "Ugh, you should have seen him when he was a baby." So, I don't know if we remember things at a young age, how we feel rejected or not, but certainly I was one who never felt right inside my own skin. I have a big nose, and I always thought that it was a curse of my grandmother on my father's side because she had the same bump on her nose, and I don't remember it until I got a bit older. But Yeah, people called me Stazola, Jimmy Durante, Elephant Nose, and left me in a place of feeling very insecure. Also found that I wasn't secure around girls, so I became their friend, and I became their confidant, and I became the go-between between boys and girls. And that was how I connected. I was a chameleon, so I fit into a lot of different groups. That was older in my life. Younger, I just felt apart from, and I felt different. But I remember my bar mitzvah. I used to have a very beautiful voice. I was a lead singer at the choir when I was younger. And during the time of the rites of passage, as a young Jewish boy, I went to a bar mitzvah, and my voice changed, and my mother got upset because, oh, he's got no voice. What are we going to do? And that affected me because I never felt I had a good singing voice at all after that. And I sang harmonies, and that was about it. So, you know, all these things going on, I played in a band, and I played bass, and of course that made me popular, and of course that was easier to meet girls, which was nice because I think a lot of my addiction is around, you know, love and all that stuff, as much as I think most addicts are. So I became very popular, and I was a very good bass player, except I always compared. You know how we say in recovery, identify, don't compare. Well, when it came to my playing, I always compared myself. And I compared myself to people that were much older than me, and they could do things I didn't. And rather than engage them and say, how do you do that? I just felt like I could never do that. See, I always got those messages when I was young. You know, you'll never amount to anything. Why can't you hang around with people who are more your caliber and all the other stuff? And Judaism was another issue that had to do with being less than. And all those things affected me psychically. So when I finally got to the point where I started getting high with older people, I started feeling a part of, I felt more powerful. I felt like I could do a lot of things. You know, there's an old expression that says, it was from Confucius, it says, first the man takes a drug, then the drug takes the drug, then the drug takes the man. And certainly in my addiction, that was a slow process that happened to me. So I'm not going to go a lot into my history or drug-a-log or any of that. It's a long time since I've done that. I can tell you about certain things about how I felt in my life. And I still, you know, all of us have the scars from our past. And all of those things always come up. And it doesn't mean that the only thing about them is I don't have to give them the credence I gave them when I was younger. And that's the important part of all that, is just not to take myself so seriously. Recovery gave me that. Recovery gave me the place of feeling good about myself. But I remember at 17, I went with some friends. We went to Provincetown, which is a gay community primarily in New England. And my friend was personal friends of the Boston Opera director. And I was alone with him, and he started coming on to me. I said, I'm not gay. He just told me, well, you better tell them all because you're going to get hit on a lot. And then he put his hands on my face, and he said, you had a beautiful face. You have a Renaissance face. And it was the first time I ever felt anybody make a compliment about me. And it felt good. It felt really good. And, you know, when you feel like you're ugly and somebody tells you that, it's a special thing. So it didn't stop me from feeling self-conscious. It didn't stop me from feeling, and just made me feel good for that moment. Because I went a long time in my life feeling less than and not a part of. And I say that I'm a loner who hates being alone, because my method of operation always was in the end to be a loner. So I'm not one who speaks linear, so if I go from place to place, just follow along, and that'll be fine. So anyway, in my addiction, I did a lot of things, and I did a lot of drugs like anybody. I'm a basic garbage head, as they put it, in treatment for me. But in 1980, in the 60s, you know, I was like the first on the block to get high in my age group. So I became the expert in that. And back then we had Donovan and electrical bananas. And people said, Bruce, how do we cook these things? And I thought, you're not going to get high over banana peels. But, you know, I told them, put it in the oven and bake it. And as stupid as it was to do, my mind still said, well, maybe you really can get high. So I ended up doing it with everybody else. And it was like a headache, and that was about it. So in the end, I did a lot of things that would hurt my body. I did a lot of things that would kill the normal human. But God has a way of finding a purpose for me when I can't find a purpose for me. I play music, and I used to use music to escape, to get to that place where I could express how I was feeling. And all that stuff was important for me. And I ran to my friend's house, and that's where I met older people, and that's where I got involved with all the stuff that I did. But I'm going to switch gears now. I'm going to go into what happened as a result of my addiction, of what was going on during the time. You know, my mother, she was supportive in this way. She would take me to my piano classes for theory and all that stuff. And when I became a recording engineer later on, my mother was very proud of me, and she was talking to her friends about the job that I had. And the job started going down. Disco ended, and the bottom dropped out of the business. And the studio I was working at was going under. And my mother looked at me because she could see that I was failing. And she said, why don't you get a real job? And when she said that, it hurt me to the core. You know, it was like a hot dagger in my chest. Here she was before touting on me and saying how great I am. And now basically she was saying the same thing she said before. What you do is insignificant and you're a bum. And again, I felt like I was never going to amount to anything. So, you know, I went on in the studio business. I kept working in the business, getting high, and less I was getting work, and more I was getting high. To the point where the people who thought I was this nice, kind, trustworthy man, boy, when I was younger, and later on, started not trusting me so much. I looked like a character from Midnight Cowboy called Ratso Rizzo. I had a wheeze in my voice and a limp in my walk. Today I have a limp in my walk because I had a stroke, but that's a whole different thing. But, you know, my friends would look at me walking down the street after I left them. They'd say, if we ever get as bad as Bruce, we'll have to quit. I hadn't quit, but I didn't even know how to quit anymore. I remember the first time I read in our basic text, Powerlessness is using against your will, gave me such a feeling of understanding of what it was I had more than anything else. Using against your will really made it special for me to know that now it's not that my life was screwed up, that my life was messed up, that everything was terrible in my life. It was that I was powerless over the disease of addiction. My life had become unmanageable. My sponsor in recovery said the unmanageability in your life is what we call in your second step the insanity of your life, because it's your thinking that makes you do the things that you do. And my sponsors were great because they taught me a lot about the practical nature of recovery and also the spiritual nature of recovery. Today, I think, just like it says in We Do Recover, This is a spiritual program. It's not part spiritual and part physical and part emotional. It's all spiritual because the body is attached to your spirit. The mind is attached to your spirit. The emotions are attached to my spirit. All those things are attached. So what I have is a condition that affects my spiritual nature. It affects me from believing that I'm whole. It affects me believing that, you know, we have an expression in recovery that most people don't hear. It says, God don't make junk. And I have a God that I believe is perfect. And I believe that perfect can't make anything that is perfect, that isn't perfect. So my significant other at the time, my girlfriend, was having a problem with me, and she was in another fellowship, and she asked her sponsor, or she told her sponsor about how frustrated she was with me, and her sponsor just smiled at her, and she wanted to know why she smiled. She said, well, Bruce is just being perfectly Bruce. So at all times, I'm always being perfectly Bruce. Not a time where, you know, defects of character are things that God wants to remove from me. But for God to remove those things, I've got to be humble enough to ask. I've got to be humble enough to know that I can't do this on my own. I got to go back to a four-step and look at the fact that my life is unmanageable as a result of my thinking and the actions that I take as a result of that thinking. That's all it is. It's very simple. Third step tells me that I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And if I understood him, that means I got him in the second step. So the second step was a very important step for me. It was a step I stayed on more than any other. Because that's the step where we find hope. That's the step where we find solutions. That one promise that God could restore us to sanity has a condition on it. So even God has conditional love. The condition is, will you let me take care of you? Make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. If I say yes to that, then God's going to say, well, show me what you're bringing to the table. If my sponsor called this a contract between me and God, God will do 99.1% of the work and I'll do the rest. But he needs to see what I'm offering. So I've got to give all that to him. And the fifth step, I look at that with my sponsor. And it says, we admit it. That means the jig is up. That means I've got to admit again that these things are true about me, the exact nature of my wrongs. I have to look at all that stuff. And my sponsor said in the sixth step, he said, are you willing? You know, this is the step where you will make a decision of the values that you want to have and live with in your life. And so I looked at that and I looked at all those defects of character. And I said, yes, I'm willing to have God remove them. But then, the proverbial shit hit the fan because my mind said, well, wait a minute. What about this? What about that? And I started getting into all kinds of jackpots because I was holding on to things. And at that point, I had to do another thing that I did in the first step. I had to ask with all my heart for God to please remove these defects of character, remove these shortcomings. And the biggest shortcoming I found I find that I have is doubt. That little thing that the mind keeps putting in there, like, will God really do what God says God can do? Time and time again, I know when I take it back, shit hits the fan. If I just let God, if I do the footwork and let the rest be, and the results, let the results be from God, things work out fine. If I try to hold on to them and try to make them happen, things get worse. You know, this year has been a tough year. The last 3 years have been tough. You know, Jay had talked about the fact I go all over the world. I've done that since 2005, right after the Hawaiian Convention, World Convention. And when I got disabled, especially in the last 3 years, I've come up with a decision that, you know, there's a lot of times I wouldn't go places because I would feel like my body can't go. And then I would ask my mind, well, what are you going to do if you don't go? Sit around the house and then you'll be lamenting over why you didn't go. So I had conversations with my mind and telling my mind, we're going in spite of what you have to say. Because why should you stay home? Why should I stay home? Because I have a disability. So I say to my mind and to anybody else, never let your disability become your handicap. This world is very big and there's no reason to sit home when, even if you have a disability, because anyone can get anywhere if they want to. Anyone can do that if they know that they have a God of their understanding like I do. They will let me go anywhere and I just look for help wherever I go. All of this comes down to the fact that no matter where I go, I always have to have help. No matter where I go, even if I were completely healthy, I would still need to have help. Even if I stayed here, I still need help. And never forget that. Never be so proud. I should never be so proud to not think that I deserve help and I can ask, and it's okay to ask other people for help. Doesn't matter whether you have 38 years or you have one day. We all still need the same thing. We all need each other. So I didn't go over a lot of steps. I went over a few of them because that's what I do. I just talk what God wants to talk to me that day. But I will say that God has told me that I'm his child. God has told me he loves me. Many people have told me they love me, so I know that God speaks through people and also reminds me how much I'm loved, reminds me how much I've helped people. No matter what I don't have that I wanted to have in my life, I'm blessed by recovery. I'm blessed by the people I have in this world. I'm blessed by a family that loves me. I'm blessed by parents that are gone, but I still love and I know they're still looking over me. I'm blessed by a lot of things in life. I should never forget that. Above all else, I should always remember that. But the one thing that is very clear to me about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps is that we carry this message to the addict that suffers. But the addict is not just the addict that we know in the room. Because I learned a long time ago in the Hindi culture, the word addiction translates to attachment. And everybody in this world is attached to something. So even though they may have written it saying, continue to help the addict who suffers, I think underneath that, God had other things in mind other than just the addict as we know the addict. We're here to serve, and we're here to help, and we're here to love. And we're here to give, and we're here to have compassion, and we're here to have all the great attributes that my God has, I want to have. And the only way I'll have them is I keep giving things away. Things like generosity, things like compassion, things like understanding, things like even taking the time to listen to somebody rather than interject. And never give my opinion as much as my experience. Experience goes a much longer way in my life than does, you know, giving somebody instructions on what to do. It's best to listen, to learn, and to serve. So anyway, I think I'm done now because my throat is hurting me a little. My tongue is definitely hurting me a little. I want to thank you all for asking me to share. God bless you all.